and welcome to Joshua Judges Ruth. Thank you. Thank you. Joshua Judges Ruth is the podcast about the Old Testament books of Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. I'm Ken Lanning. Thank you for joining me today for episode 2.01, the Book of Judges. It's been 40 years since I last put out a podcast, and that is too long. Let's get this thing started with the Book of Judges. When you first think of Judges, you might think of all those stories you learned as a kid, like the one where Samson tied the foxes together by their tails, or the one where he tells the riddle about the dead lion. Maybe even the one where he is pestered into telling Delilah the secret of his great strength. For sure you heard about Gideon and how he defeated the Midianites with his army of 300 men, kind of like those guys at Thermopylae. But I'm going to bet there are a few stories from the Book of Judges you didn't hear when you were a kid. The adults in your life were too responsible to share with you some of the old ultra-violence we find in Judges. Let's be honest, if Mel Gibson made a movie about the Book of Judges, it would be a very, very hard R. You'd probably have to find it in the horror or slasher film section of your Blockbuster, or wherever the kids rent their movies these days. And by the way, I would totally watch that Mel Gibson movie. Right off the bat, in Judges, you got the Judahites cutting off the thumbs and big toes of Adonai Bezek. Then you got Ehud sticking a knife so far into a fat guy's belly it's enveloped by the cellulite. Then there's Jael, a lady, by the way, who drives a tent peg through Sisera's head while he sleeps. Even Samson beats down 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of an ass. The book ends with probably one of the most gruesome stories in all the Bible, right up there with mothers agreeing to eat each other's babies. 2 Kings chapter 6, by the way. And with the added atrocity of gang rape. So maybe it's no wonder the only stories we were told from Judges when we were kids were the PG stories and sanitized versions at that. Well, we're not going to shy away from any of the R-rated stories. We're going to go verse by verse and wring every gory detail out of Judges and find out if it has anything to teach us in our modern civilized world where no one ever does anything bad to anyone. But a couple of things before we get started. Don't forget to rate my podcast on iTunes. I don't have even one review, and frankly, that hurts my feelings. I piddle around and put out a show about every 6 months, and not even one person can muster enough energy to give me a lackluster review. Seriously, though, 5-star reviews work best, but if you must, other kinds of reviews are accepted, as long as they're 5-star reviews. And I swear on Samson's hair, if you follow me at OT_JJR on Twitter, I'll start tweeting on that account more. Follow me at KenKenKenUSA for all of my other silly tweets. Don't forget the website for the podcast, joshuajudgesruth.com. I don't generally put a lot there, but this past weekend I went to a traveling tabernacle display and I posted some pics. A church has built a replica of the Tent of Meeting, the very one the children of Israel, namely the Kohathites, carried around with them while wandering in the desert. The creators of this display built the tabernacle, the altar, the basin, and all the items that went in the tabernacle, which included the lamp, the table for the bread, the incense altar, and even the Ark of the Covenant. It's all built to scale as much as possible. We don't know the dimensions of all the items, like the lamp, for instance. They did cheat a little on the tabernacle itself. It was probably closer to 15 feet high, and theirs was 11 feet, but they admitted that. Like I said, I posted a few pics from that visit, but keep in mind, we weren't supposed to take any photographs, so I had to furtively snap them when no one was looking. I'm a bit of a rule follower, and I generally try to comply, but I thought that you, my dear listener, would be interested in seeing what the tabernacle might look like in our modern day. Also, it was pouring down rain all day, so we were all a little cold and damp. And just to clarify, they didn't want us to take pictures because it was supposed to be a time of quiet reflection and meditation, and they didn't want us to ruin the mood with selfies. So there you go. One more thing about the visit. Since I'm a rule follower and I was already pushing it with the pics I did take, I didn't get any pics from inside the tent. They had a person parked in there, and there were others besides my family going through, and I knew my flash would blind everyone. However, because I knew you would want to know, I did touch the Ark. Now, I knew it wasn't the real Ark, but I still reached out and touched it the way I touch a wire to see if it still has juice running through it. Once I was sure I wouldn't keel over like Uzzah, the son of Abinadab, in 2 Samuel 6, I tried to raise the lid, the mercy seat. But alas, it was all one piece and wouldn't come off. But enough of this groveling for reviews and follows and day trips to the see the tent of meeting. Who wrote the book of Judges? Well, we don't really know. I know that's an unsatisfying answer, but it's the truth. It's traditionally attributed to Samuel, the last judge of Israel, and don't worry, I'll explain what a judge is later. Both the rabbinic sages and Christian tradition have given credit to Samuel, but the book itself doesn't tell us, and nowhere else in the Bible does it state Samuel wrote Judges. Why do people think Samuel wrote Judges? It seems to be primarily because of his close proximity to the events in the book. As I said, Samuel was the last judge of Israel, and he anointed the first and second kings of Israel. It seems like someone in his position could reasonably make the statement that appears four times in Judges, quote, "In those days there was no king in Israel." He also maintains some kind of chronicle per 1 Chronicles 29:29. Even if Samuel wrote it, the stories must have existed in some form before his day. At some point, the stories were compiled and fashioned into the book we know today, complete with the cycles of obedience, sin, oppression, repentance, and deliverance. Scholars tell us that the book was probably put together by the same folks who compiled / wrote the rest of the Deuteronomistic history, that is, Deuteronomy through 2 Kings. When was the book of Judges written? Well, if Samuel wrote it, then we're looking at a date at around the turn of the millennium. That's 1000 BC. But scholars will tell us there is little chance Samuel wrote it, and so if it was fashioned by the Deuteronomistic historians, then we're looking at a date in around the 6th century BC, perhaps during the Babylonian exile. I need to quit including that word Deuteronomistic. Deuteronomistic. Now, like I said, the scholars will tell us that these stories from Judges probably predated the compilation of the Deuteronomistic history and existed in oral tradition long before editors began to write them down and put them into collections. In other words, somebody at some point collected and organized these stories from Judges into a history of the 12 tribes and along the way, as many contend, made the case for a king as well as allegiance to the Lord, that is Yahweh. Many scholars believe that Judges actually gives us a more realistic picture of ancient Israel and how it was formed. They will say there is little chance that the children of Israel came into the land from Egypt and took it by force. If you'll remember from the last episode 40 years ago, one of the theories about the Israelites' origins is that they were just always there in Canaan, living amongst the Canaanites. There was no central authority, and they were certainly not a nation. And that is essentially what we have from the book of Judges. We see a loose confederation of tribes who band together at times to fight a common enemy. We'll note, however, that when they banded together, not all the tribes were up for every battle. It's a very different picture than what we saw in Joshua, where all the tribes fought alongside of each other. Also in Joshua, we saw the Israelites were devoted to the Lord and apparently did not stray far from his teaching. Achan did it, and it led to disastrous results for the army and then for he and his family. But otherwise, we don't see the Israelites turning to other gods in the book of Joshua. In the book of Judges, the Israelites love them some Baals and Asherah. I'll talk more about these gods once we get into it. Why is the book called Judges? That's a good question. Anything you pick up to read about the book of Judges will say something like, the book is named for the series of leaders who rose up to deliver Israel from their oppressors and were not necessarily judges in the judicial sense. They were generals, chieftains, warlords, prophets, and priests. There was one judge who did actually hear cases, and that was the Judge Deborah, the only lady judge that we know of. So with all of that out of the way, why don't we jump into chapter 1, verse 1. To stay consistent with our timeline, which I've talked about a lot on here, we're looking at the book of Judges picking up at around 1376 BC, following the death of Joshua. In verse 1, we see we're picking up the action after the death of Joshua. They asked the Lord, that is, Yahweh, who should go up first to fight the Canaanites? Now, we know from the book of Joshua that there are still Canaanites in the land. They were not all driven off like refugees, and they weren't all slaughtered. There were still parts of Canaan left to conquer. It is interesting, at least to me, why one tribe needed to fight first in this scenario. Why wouldn't they band together to fight the Canaanites as one nation? So right off the bat, we see this loose confederation. The Deuteronomists place the book of Judges right after the book of Joshua as a continuation of the story, but some scholars today look at the book of Judges as an alternate history of Israel, if not a more realistic picture of ancient Israel. That's why we see here the various tribes warring with their neighbors rather than an all-out conquest by a nation new to the scene. The Lord says Judah should go up first. If you're looking for reasons to believe that the author of Judges was looking to make Judah a prominent tribe, laying the groundwork for a line of kings that descends from the tribe of Judah, here you go. Judah's told to go up first because the Lord has given the land into his hand. But Judah looks for an ally, and they choose Simeon, which makes a lot of sense. The territory allotted to Simeon is encompassed by the territory allotted to Judah. On most maps of the 12 tribes of Israel, Simeon is a nebulous blob somewhere in the middle of Judah. They weren't only landlocked, but they were bordered by only one other entity, that being Judah, sort of the way Vatican City is surrounded by Rome. The tribe of Simeon had descended from the second son of Jacob, who he had with his wife Leah, the wife he did not love. The same Simeon, the second son, took part in the massacre at Shechem. I talked about this in episode 1.7. Jacob was very put out by Simeon and his accomplice Levi because of the attack. When the sons of Jacob went down to Egypt to buy grain, Simeon is the one Joseph held hostage until his brothers returned. Later, in Genesis 49, when Jacob tells the fortunes to each of his sons, he reminds everyone that Simeon and Levi killed in anger, awkward, and as a result, quote, I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. In other words, they don't get any land in Canaan. We for sure see that the tribe of Levi was not given a tract of land per se, but had cities throughout the 12 tribes. Perhaps this is what we're seeing when Simeon has to make do with some acreage within Judah. The other thing about Simeon is we see some significant decline in number in the book of Numbers. Per Numbers chapter 1, there were 59,300 fighting-aged men in Simeon. By the time we get to Numbers 26, there were 22,200. Simeon quit having babies somewhere along the way. In that same span, some of the other tribes increased, others decreased as well, but only by a couple thousand or so, not the 37,000 decrease Simeon saw. And if getting some borderless piece of land within Judah and seeing most of your tribe die off wasn't bad enough, Simeon isn't even mentioned in the blessing of Moses in Deuteronomy 33. Levi and the other tribes receive Moses' attention, but not Simeon. Poor Simeon. We may talk more about Simeon later, but let's leave him for now. So Simeon agrees to go with Judah, and they defeat the Canaanites and the Perizzites. In fact, the Lord gives them into their hands, and they defeat 10,000 men at Bezek. Now, this is the first time Bezek shows up in the Bible. I guess we have to assume that it is a different Bezek than what we see in Samuel 11, where King Saul gathers the army for a battle, because that Bezek is farther north in Manasseh's territory, but it's hard to say. The man we assume to be the leader of the Canaanite and Perizzite coalition here is named Adonai Bezek. Now, it doesn't actually say he's the king of Bezek, but with that name, you would assume that. They catch Adonai Bezek, and right here in verse 6, right off the bat in the book of Judges, is why I love the book of Judges. Verse 6 says, they catch Adonai Bezek and cut off his thumbs and big toes. It's just one of those acts that's so far removed from the culture I live in, at least. And it's stated so matter-of-factly that it catches your attention and makes you say, they did what now? In verse 7, Adonai Bezek says, quote, 70 kings with their thumbs and their big toes cut off used to gather up scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. We assume this is eye for an eye retribution, and Adonai Bezek acknowledges he deserved it. However, it does not seem to be in keeping with the Lord's command to drive out or kill the inhabitants of Canaan. Verse 7 goes on to say that they brought Adonai Bezek to Jerusalem, and he died there, presumably after living out his life in slavery. Or perhaps infection set in on those four wounds he suffered on his hands and feet. So we need to pause just a bit and talk about Adonai Bezek a little more. His name seems to mean Lord Bezek, or my Lord is Bezek. The Adonai is the word we translate Lord with lowercase letters in our English Bibles. As a reminder, when we see Lord in uppercase letters in our English Bibles, it's usually Yahweh that is being translated. I talked way back in episode 1.3 about why our Bibles read Lord versus Yahweh, and said basically it was due to tradition. At some point, Jews quit pronouncing Yahweh for fear of breaking the third commandment. In that spirit, English translators have traditionally used Lord instead of Yahweh. A Hebrew reader would read Adonai or Adonai in place of Yahweh. If you remember, way back in Joshua chapter 10, we ran across a guy named Adonai Zedek. His name would mean something like Lord Righteous, which coincidentally is the name of my Christian metal band. LOL, JK. Adonai Zedek was the king of Jerusalem, and he led a coalition against Joshua, but was defeated and walled up in a cave at Makkedah. Later, Joshua opened the mouth of the cave and killed Adonai Zedek, along with four other kings who hid with him. Some have postulated that Adonai Zedek and Adonai Bezek are one and the same based on the similarities of their names, the one being a corruption of the other. The biblical account does not seem to support that. There's no mention here that Adonai Bezek fought against Joshua or was aligned with the kings mentioned in Joshua 10. Adonai Bezek does not seem to be the king of Jerusalem mentioned in Joshua 10, though there are other questions about the capture of Jerusalem that we'll get into momentarily. Let me just insert this here. Remember, the king of Jerusalem who shows up in the Amarna letters is named Abdehiba. So let's get back to Joshua chapter 10 again. Again, we see that Adonai Zedek, the king of Jerusalem, was one of the kings Joshua defeated there at Makkedah. The king of Jerusalem is again listed in Joshua 12, along with the other 30 kings Joshua defeated. Skip ahead to Joshua 15:63, and we read this, quote, Now, as for the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the sons of Judah could not drive them out. So the Jebusites live with the sons of Judah at Jerusalem until this day. At whatever time this passage was formed, the Jebusites still held Jerusalem. If we're trying to reconcile this with Joshua 10, we might say that Joshua captured and killed the king of Jerusalem at that time, but he did not capture Jerusalem itself. Indeed, Joshua 10 does not state that the Israelites captured Jerusalem at that time. Back here at Judges 1:8, Judah fights against Jerusalem and actually captures and burns it. Okay, so great, we finally got rid of those pesky Jebusites, right? Well, not quite. Even though 1:8 says Judah burned Jerusalem, if we skip ahead to 1:21, we read this, quote, The sons of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem, so the Jebusites have lived with the sons of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. That sounds a lot like Joshua 15:63, but instead of Judah not driving out the Jebusites, Benjamin gets blamed. So, spoiler alert, if we skip ahead to 2 Samuel 5, we see that David finally defeats the Jebusites and takes the city and makes it his capital. How did the conquest of Jerusalem play out? If we want to draw a straight line from Joshua through 2 Samuel 5, it might go something like this. Joshua kills the king of Jerusalem, but doesn't take the city. The Jebusites continued to live in Jerusalem. After Joshua's death, Judah takes Jerusalem and burns it, but they don't occupy it. the Jebusites come back in and rebuild. Since Jerusalem is on the border of Benjamin and Judah, the Benjamites try to take it but cannot, and the Jebusites remain. Finally, David is able to capture the city and sets up his capital there. And of course, the taking and retaking of Jerusalem goes on and on up till today, but we won't go into that now. There could be another way to look at it. We haven't discussed this yet, but chapter 1 and part of chapter 2 of Judges may be a different perspective of Joshua's conquest. That's hard to reconcile because right there in verse 1 we read, "Now it came about after the death of Joshua." But if we look ahead, Joshua dies again in Judges 2:8. We also see that Debir is taken again in Judges 1, and we have the story of Othniel taking Kiriath Sefer again in Judges 1. We previously read of Caleb's conquest in Joshua 15. There is, of course, the possibility that the exploits of Caleb in Joshua 15 didn't happen until later after the death of Joshua, but it's hard to say. Judges 1 and 2 obviously revisits material already covered in Joshua, but with the added details and the text stating that Joshua had died, it makes it difficult to draw a nice straight line. So with that, let's move on to verses 9 and 10. Here we see Judah fighting against Hebron, and they kill Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai, just like we read in Joshua 15. In verse 11, Judah takes Debir, just like Caleb did in Joshua 15, and at verse 12, there begins a retelling of the story of Othniel taking Kiriath Sefer and thus winning his cousin Achsah's hand in marriage. I walked through that story in episode 1.17. There are some interesting interpretation challenges in that little anecdote, so I encourage you to listen or look into that on your own. At verse 16, we see the Kenites chose to settle with Judah. No, the Kenites aren't my descendants. They're actually the descendants of Reuel, Moses' father-in-law. They came up from the city of palms. We don't know exactly what is meant by that. It could be any town with a grove of palms, but elsewhere in the Bible, Jericho is called the city of palm trees. In verse 17, Judah and Simeon take Zephath. That is the only time that name appears in the Bible. However, they utterly destroyed it, and so the city was called Hormah, which is a word that means devoted. So the city was set aside for destruction, similar to Jericho. Now, I'm no linguist, so I shouldn't even be going there, but the word that the Bible uses to describe Jericho is harem, which means a thing devoted or banned. It would appear that Zephath suffered a fate similar to Jericho. In verse 18, Judah takes Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. This is another verse that would lead us to believe these events happened after the death of Joshua, because in Joshua 13:2, we're told that the children of Israel did not capture any of the Philistine territory, and these cities are Philistine. We'll hear much more about the Philistines later on, I'm sure. Verse 19 is interesting, quote, "Now the Lord was with Judah, and they took possession of the hill country. But they could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had iron chariots." The word valley is alternatively translated plain or lowlands. Chariots would be of little use in the hill country of Judah, and so they were fighting on equal footing when on the hills. But once they get down on the plain, they come up against superior military technology. The iron chariots must have seemed like F/A-18s to these Judahites, who apparently did not have chariots or horses. But the Israelites had faced chariots before and had prevailed. We covered that in episodes 1.13 and episodes 1.14. In Joshua 11, the Israelites defeat the alliance the king of Hazor had formed. Jabin, the king of Hazor, had iron chariots, and he had as many men in his army as there are sands on the seashore. Yet the Lord promised Joshua victory, and the Israelites prevailed. That makes verse 19 interesting to me because the Lord appears to help Judah in the hills, but he is not with them on the plain because they cannot defeat the armies with the chariots. Perhaps Judah failed to trust the Lord in the plains and forgot the victory at Hazor. At verse 20, Caleb gets the land he was promised, just like we're told in Joshua, and in verse 21, we see the Benjamites now cannot drive out the Jebusites from Jerusalem, which we've discussed. And with that, I think we'll call it a day. We'll for sure get through the rest of Judges chapter 1 next time. Stay tuned. We've only scratched the surface of Judges, both in the narrative and the background. Until next time, be strong and courageous. Have I not commanded you?